This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Chapter 1 of Sir Charles Danvers. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Simon Evers. Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. Chapter 1.
Dear heart, Miss Ruth, my dear, now don't ye be a-going yet, and me that hasn't set eyes on ye this month and more, and as hardly hears a body speak from morning till night.
Come, come, Mrs. Eccles, I am always finding people sitting here. I expect to see the latch go every minute.
Well, and if they do, and some folks are always a-dropping in, and a-setting themselves down, and a-clack-clacking till a body can't get a bit of peace. And the things they say, eh, Miss Ruth, the things I've heard folks say, a-setting as it might be there, in poor Eccles's old chair by the chimney, as the Lord took him in.
To the uninitiated, Mrs. Eccles' allusion might have seemed to refer to photography, but Ruth knew better. A visitation from the Lord being synonymous in Slumberly Parish with a fall from a ladder, a stroke of paralysis, or the midnight cartwheel that disabled Brown when returning late from the Blue Dragon, not quite himself.
"No," resumed Mrs. Eccles with an extensive sigh, "there's a deal of talk in the village now," glancing inquisitively at the visitor, "about him as succeeds to old Mr. Dare. But I never listened to their tales."
They made a pleasant contrast to each other, the neat old woman with her shrewd, spectacled eyes and active, hard-working fingers, and the young girl, tranquil, graceful, sitting in the shadow, with her slender, ungloved hands in her lap. They were not sitting in the front parlour, because Ruth was an old acquaintance, but Mrs. Eccles had a front parlour with a bottled-up smell in it, peculiar to front parlours, a parlour with a real mahogany table, which photograph albums and a few select volumes were symmetrically arranged round an inkstand, nestling in a very choice woodwork mat. A parlour with wax flowers under glass shades on the mantelpiece, and an avalanche of paper roses and mixed paper herbs in the fireplace. Ruth knew that sacred apartment well. She knew the name of each of the books. She had expressed a proper admiration for the wax flowers. She had heard, though she might have forgotten, for she was but young, the price of the real Brussels carpet, and so she might safely be permitted to sit in the kitchen and watch Mrs. Eccles darning her son's socks. I am almost afraid Ruth liked the kitchen best, with its tiled floor and patch of afternoon sun, with its tall clock in the corner, its line of straining geraniums in the low window shelf, and its high mantelpiece crowned by two china dogs with red lozenges on them, holding baskets in their mouths.
"Yes, a deal of talk there is, but nobody right seems to know anything for certain," continued Mrs. Eccles, spreading out her hands in the heel of a fresh sock and pouncing on a modest hole. "You see, we never gave a thought to him, with that great hearty Mr. George, his eldest brother, to succeed when the old gentleman went. And such a fine figure of a man in his clothes as poor Mr. George used to be, and such a favourite with his old uncle. And then to be took like that, horseback riding at Pola, only 6 weeks after the old gentleman. But I can't hear as anybody's set eyes on his half-brother as comes in for the property now. He never came to Vanden in his uncle's lifetime. They say old Mr. Dare couldn't bide the French madam as his brother took when his first wife died, a foreigner with black curls. It wasn't likely. He was always partial to Mr. George, and he took him up when his father died, but he never would have anything to say to this younger one, being nothing in the world, so folks say, but half a French and black like his mother. I wonder now," began Mrs. Eccles, tentatively, with her usual love of information. "I wonder now," interposed Ruth quietly, "how the rheumatism is getting on. I saw you were in church on Sunday evening."
"Yes, my dear," began Mrs. Eccles, readily diverted to a subject of such interest as herself. "Yes, I always come to the evening service now, though I won't deny as the rheumatics are very pinching at times. But, dear Lord, I never come up to the stalls near the chancel, so you ain't likely to see me. To see them Harrises always a-going up to the very top, it does go again me. I don't say as is everybody as ought to take the lowest place. The Lord knows I'm not proud, but I won't go into them chairs down by the font myself. But to see them Harrises, that to my certain knowledge hasn't a bite of butcher's meat in their heads but once a week, a-setting themselves up! Now, Mrs. Eccles, you know perfectly well all the seats are free in the evening. And so they may be, Miss Ruth, my dear, and don't ye be a-getting up yet. And good Christians, I'm sure, the quality are to abide it. And it did my heart good to hear the Honourable John preaching as he did in his new surplice, as Witter Pick always puts too much blue in the surplices to my thinking, all about rich and poor and one with another. A beautiful sermon it was, but it wouldn't come up like them Harrises. There's things as is suitable, and there's things as is not. No, I keep to my own place, and I have to turn out old Bessie Pugh this very last Sunday night, as I found her cocked up there, though I was not a matter of 5 minutes late. Bessie Pugh always was one to take upon herself, and as I often says to her when I hear her going on about free grace and the like, "Bessie," I says, "if I was a widder on the parish, and not so much as a pig to fat up for Christmas, and coming to church regular on Loaf Sunday, which is not that I ain't sorry for ye, but I wouldn't take upon myself, if I was you, to talk of things as I better leave to them as is beholden to nobody, and pays their rent regular. I've no patience. But hey, dear Mrs. Ruth, look at that gentleman going down the road, and the dog too. Why, ye haven't so much as got up. He's gone. He was a foreigner, and no mistake. Why, good Lord, there he is coming back again. He sees me through the window. Mercy on us, he's opening the gate. He's coming to the door." As she spoke, a shadow passed before the window, and someone knocked. Mrs. Eccles hastily thrust her darning needle into the front of her bodice, the general rendezvous of the pins and needles of the establishment, and proceeded to open the door and plant herself in front of it. Ruth caught a glimpse of an erect, light grey figure in the sunshine, surmounted by a brown face and the lightest of light grey hats. Close behind stood a black poodle of a dignified and self-engrossed deportment, wearing its body half-shaved, but breaking out in ruffles round its paws, and a tuft at the end of a stiffly undemonstrative tail. "The key of the church is kept at Jones's by the pump," said Mrs. Eccles, in the brusque manner peculiar to the free-born Briton when brought in contact with a foreigner. "Thank you, madam," was the reply, in the most courteous of tones, and the grey hat was off in a moment, showing a very dark, cropped head. "But I do not look for the church. I only ask for the way to the house of the pastor, Mr. Erlewine." Mrs. Eccles gave full and comprehensive directions in a very high key, accompanied by much gesticulation, and then the grey hat was replaced, and the grey figure, followed by the black poodle, marched down the little garden path again, and disappeared from view. Mrs. Eccles drew a long breath, and turned to her visitor again. "Well, my dear, did ye ever see the like of that? And his head, Miss Ruth, did ye take note of his head? Not so much as a shadow of a parting. All the same, all the way over, and asking the way to the rectory? Why, you ain't never going yet. Well, good-bye, my dear, God bless ye. And now," soliloquized Mrs. Eccles, as Ruth finally escaped, "I may as well run across to Jones's and see if they know anything about the gentleman, and if he's put up at the inn." It was a glorious July afternoon, but it was hot. The roads were white, and the tall hedgerows grey with dust. A wagon-load of late hay, with a swarm of children just out from school careering round it, was coming up the road in a dim cloud of dust. Ruth, who had been undecided which way to take, beat a hasty retreat towards the churchyard, deciding that if she must hesitate, to do so among cool tombstones in the shade. She glanced up at the church clock, and she selected her tombstone under one of the many yew-trees in the old churchyard. 4:30, and already an inner voice was suggesting tea. To miss 5 o'clock tea on a thirsty afternoon like this was not to be thought of for a moment. She had no intention of going back to tea at Atherston, where she was staying with her cousins, Mr. and Mrs. Danvers. Two alternatives remained. Should she go to Slumberly Hall, close by, and see the Thursbys, who she knew had all returned from London yesterday, or should she go across the fields to Slumberly Rectory, and have tea with Uncle John and Aunt Fanny? She knew that Sir Charles Danvers, Ralph Danvers's elder brother, was expected at Atherston this afternoon. His aunt, Lady Mary Cunningham, was also staying there, partly with a view of meeting him. Ralph Danvers had not seen his brother, nor Lady Mary her nephew, for some time, and, judging by the interest they seemed to feel in his visit, Ruth had determined not to interrupt a family meeting, in which she imagined she might be de trop. "My fine tact," she thought, "will enable them to have a quiet talk among themselves till nearly dinner-time. But I must not neglect myself any longer. The hall is nearer, and the drive is shady. But to put against that, Mabel will insist on showing me her new gowns, and Mrs. Thursby will make her usual remarks about Aunt Fanny. No, in spite of that burning expanse of glebe, I will go to tea at the rectory. I have not seen Uncle John for a week, and, who knows, perhaps Aunt Fanny may be out." So the gloves were put on, the crisp white dress shaken out, the parasol put up, and Ruth took the narrow church path across the fields up to Slumberley Rectory. For many years since the death of her parents, Ruth Danecourt had lived with her grandmother, a wealthy, witty, and wise old lady, whose house had been considered one of the pleasantest in London by those to whom pleasant houses are open. Lady Danecourt, a beauty in her youth, a beauty in middle life, a beauty in her old age, had seen and known all the marked men of the last two generations, and had reminiscences to tell which increased in point and flavour like old wine the longer they were kept. She frequented as a girl the Mrs. Berry's drawing-room, and people were wont to say that hers was the nearest approach to a salon which remained after the Mrs. Berry disappeared. She had married a grave politician, a rising man whom she had pushed into a knighthood, and at one time into the ministry. If he had died before he could make her the wife of a premier, the disappointment had not been without its alleviations. She had never possessed much talent for domestic life, and, the yoke once removed, she had not felt the least inclination to take it upon herself again. As a widow, her way through life was one long, triumphal procession. She had daughters, dull, tall, serious girls, with whom she had nothing in common, whom she educated well, brought out, laced in, and then married, one after another, relinquishing the last with the utmost cheerfulness, and refusing the condolences of friends on her lonely position with her usual frankness. But her son, her only son, she had loved. He was like her, and understood her, and was at ease with her, as her daughters had never been. The trouble of her life was the death of her son. She got over it, and she got over everything. But when, several years afterwards, his widow, with whom it is hardly necessary to say she was not on speaking terms, suddenly died, being a faint-hearted, feeble creature, Lady Danecourt immediately took possession of her grandchildren, a boy and two girls, and proceeded as far as in her lay to ruin the boy for life. "A woman," she was apt to remark in after years, "is not intended by nature to manage any man except her husband. I am a warning to the mothers, aunts, and grandmothers, particularly the grandmothers, of the future. A husband is a sufficient field for the employment of a woman's whole energies. I went beyond my sphere, and I am punished." And when Raymond Danecourt finally disappeared in America for the last time, having been fished up therefrom on several occasions, each time in worse case than the last, she excommunicated him, and cheerfully altered her will, dividing the £60,000 she had it in her power to leave between her two granddaughters, and letting the fact become known, with the result that Anna was married by the end of her second season. And if at the end of 5 seasons Ruth was still unmarried, she had, as Lady Danecourt took care to inform people, no one to thank for it but herself. But in reality, now that Anna was provided for, Lady Danecourt was in no hurry to part with Ruth. She liked her as much as it was possible for her to like anyone. Indeed, I think she even loved her in a way. She had taken but small notice of her while she was in the schoolroom, for she cared little about girls as a rule. But as she grew up, tall, erect, with the pale, stately beauty of a lily, Lady Danecourt's heart went out to her. None of her own daughters had been so distinguished-looking, so ornamental. Ruth's clothes always looked well on her, and she had a knack of entertaining people, and much taste in the arrangement of flowers. Though she had inherited the Danecourt earnestness of character, together with their dark, serious eyes, and a certain annoying rigidity as to right and wrong, these defects were counterbalanced by flashes of brightness and humour, which reminded Lady Dacre of herself in her own brilliant youth, and inclined her to be lenient when in her daughter's cases she would have been sarcastic. The old woman and the young one had been great friends, and not the less so, perhaps, because of a tacit understanding which existed between them that certain subjects should be avoided, upon which each instinctively felt they were not likely to agree. And if the shrewd old woman of the world ever suspected the existence of a strength of will and depth of character in Ruth, such as had, in her own early life, been a source of annoyance and perplexity to herself in her dealings with her husband, she was skilful enough to ignore any traces of it that showed themselves in her granddaughter, and thus avoided those collisions of will, results of which she felt might have been doubtful. And so Ruth had lived a life full of varied interests and among interesting people, and had been waked up suddenly in a grey and frosted dawn to find that chapter of her life closed. Lady Dacre, who never thought of travelling without her maid and footman, suddenly went on a long journey along one wild January morning, starting, without any previous preparation, for a land in which she had never professed much interest heretofore. It seemed a pity that she should have to die when she had so thoroughly acquired the art of living, with little trouble to herself and much pleasure to others, but so it was. And then, in Ruth's confused remembrance of what followed, all the world seemed to have turned to black and grey. There was no colour anywhere where all had been colour before. Miles of black cloth and crape seemed to extend before her. Black horses came and stamped black hoof-marks in the snow before the door. Endless arrangements had to be made, endless letters to be written. Something was carried heavily downstairs, all in black, scoring the wall at the turn on the stairs, in a way which would have annoyed Lady Dacre exceedingly if she had been there to see it. But she had left several days before it happened. The last pale shadow of the kind, gay little grandmother was gone from the great front bedroom upstairs. Mr. Alwyn, one of Ruth's uncles, came up from the country and went to the funeral, and took Ruth away afterwards. Her own sister Anna was abroad with her husband. Her brother Raymond had not been heard of for years. As she drove away from the house and looked up at the windows with wide, tearless eyes, she suddenly realised that this departure was final, that there would be no coming back, no home left for her in the familiar rooms where she and another had lived so long together. Mr. Alwyn was by her side in the carriage, patting her cold hands and telling her not to cry, which she felt no inclination to do. And then, seeing the blank pallor in her face, he suddenly found himself fumbling for his own pocket handkerchief. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 2. On this particular July afternoon, Mr. Alwyn, or, as his parishioners called him, the Honourable John, was sitting in his armchair in the little drawing-room of Slumberley Rectory. Mrs. Honourable John was pouring out tea, and here, once and for all, let it be known that meals, particularly 5 o'clock tea, will occupy a large place in this chronicle, not because of any importance especially attaching to them, but because in the country, at least in Slumberley, the day is not divided by hours, but by the meals that take place therein, and to write of Slumberley and its inhabitants with disregard to the divisions of time is impossible and cannot be done. So I repeat boldly, Mr. and Mrs. Alwyn were at tea. They were alone together, for they had no children, and Ruth Dacre, who had been living with them since her grandmother's death in the winter, was now staying with her cousin, Mrs. Ralph Danvers, at Atherston, a couple of miles away. If it had occasionally crossed Mr. Alwyn's mind during the last few months that he would have liked to have a daughter like Ruth, he kept the sentiment to himself, as he did most sentiments in the company of his wife, who, while she complained of his habit of silence, made up for it nobly herself at all times and in all places. It had often been the subject of vague wonder among his friends, and even at times to Mr. Alwyn himself, how he had come to marry Fanny, my love. Mr. Alwyn dearly loved peace and quiet, but these dwelt not under the same roof with Mrs. Alwyn. Nay, I even believe, if the truth were known, he liked order and tidiness, judging by the exact arrangement of his own study, and the rueful glances he sometimes cast at the litter of wools and letters on the newspaper table, and the gay garden hats and galoshes hidden but not concealed under the drawing-room sofa. Conversation about the dearness of butcher's meat and the enormities of servants palled upon him, I think, after a time, but he had taken his wife's style of conversation for better for worse when he took her gaily dressed self under those ominous conditions, and he never showed impatience. He loved his wife, but I think it grieved him when smart-coloured glass vases were strewn among the cherished bits of old china and enamel which his soul loved. He did not like chromolithographs, or the framed photographs which Mrs. Albin called her mementums of travel, among his rare old prints, either. He bore them, but after their arrival in company with large and inappropriate nails, and especially after the cut-glass candlesticks appeared on the drawing-room chimney-piece, he ceased to make his little occasional purchases of old china and old silver. The curiosity shops knew him no more, or if he still at times brought home some treasure in his hat-box on his return from convocation, it was unpacked and examined in private, and a little place was made for it among the old Chelsea figures on the bookcase in his study, which had stood, ever since he had inherited them from his father, on the drawing-room mantelpiece, but had been silently removed when a pair of comic china elephants playing on violins had appeared in their midst. Mr. Albin sighed a little when he looked at them this afternoon, and shook his head, for had he not brought back in his empty soup tin an old earthenware cow of Dutch extraction, which had long coveted on the shelf of a parishioner? He bought it very dear, for when in all his life had he ever bought anything cheap? And now, as he was tenderly wiping a suspicion of beef tea off it, he wondered, as he looked round his study, where he could put it. Not among the old Oriental china, where bits of Wedgwood had already elbowed in for want of room elsewhere. Among his low-stuffed cups and saucers? Never. He would rather not have it than see it there. He had a vision of a certain bracket, discarded from the hall, and put aside by his careful hands in the lowest drawer of the cupboard by the window, in which he kept little stores of nails and string and brown paper, among which Fanny, my love, performed fearful ravages when minded to tie up a parcel. Mr. Albin nailed up the bracket under an old etching, and placed the cow thereon, and after contemplating it over his spectacles, went into the drawing-room to tea with his wife. Mrs. Albin was a stout, florid, good-humoured-looking woman, with a battered fringe, considerably younger than her husband in appearance, and with a tendency to bright colours in dress. "Barnes is very poorly, my dear," said Mr. Albin, patiently fishing out one of the lumps of sugar which his wife had put in his tea. He took one lump, but she took two herself, and consequently always gave him two. "I should say a little strong soup would." At this juncture, the front doorbell rang, and a moment afterwards Mr. Dare was announced. The erect, light-grey figure which had awakened the curiosity of Mrs. Eccles came in close behind the servant. Mrs. Arwin received a deep bow in return for her look of astonishment, and then, with an eager exclamation, the visitor had seized both Mr. Arwin's hands, regardless of the neatly folded slice of bread and butter in one of them, and was shaking them cordially. Mr. Albin looked for a moment as astonished as his wife, and the blank, deprecating glance he cast at his visitor showed that he was at a loss. The latter let go his hands and spread his own out with a sudden gesture. "Ah, you do not know me," he said, speaking rapidly. "It is 20 years ago, and you have forgotten. You do not remember Alfred Dare, the little boy whom you last saw in sailing costume, the little boy for whom you cut the whistles, the son of your old friend Henry Dare?" "Good gracious!" ejaculated Mr. Albin with a sudden flash of memory. "Henry's other son. I remember now. It is Alfred, and I remember the whistles, too. You have your mother's eyes, and of course you've come to Vanden now that your poor brother. We have all been wondering when you would turn up. My dear boy, I remember you perfectly now, but it is a long time ago, and you have changed very much." "Between 8 years and 28 there is a great step," replied Dare, with a brilliant smile. "How could I expect that you should remember all at once? But you are not changed. I knew the first moment. It is the same kind, good face which I remember well." Mr. Albin blushed a faint blush, which any word of praise could always call up, and then, reminded of the presence of Mrs. Albin by a short cough, which that lady always had in readiness wherewith to recall him to a sense of duty, he turned to her and introduced Dare. Dare made another beautiful bow, and while he accepted a cup of tea from Mrs. Albin, Mr. Albin had time to look attentively at him with his mild grey eyes. He was a slight, active-looking young man of middle height, decidedly un-English in appearance and manner, with dark, roving eyes, moustaches very much twirled up, and a lean, brown face that was exceedingly handsome in a style to which Mr. Elwin was not accustomed. And this was Henry Dare's second son, the son by his French wife, who had been brought up abroad, of whom no one had ever heard or cared to hear, who had now succeeded by his half-brother's sudden death to Vanden, a property adjoining Slumberley. The eager, foreign face was becoming familiar to Mr. Elwin. Dare was like his mother, but he sat exactly as Mr. Elwin had seen his father sit many a time in that very chair. The attitude was the same. Ah, but the flourish of the brown hands! How unlike anything Henry would have done! And those sudden movements! He was roused by Dare turning quickly to him again. "I am telling Mrs. Elwin of my journey here," he began, "of how I miss my train, of how I miss my carriage sent to meet me from the inn, of how I walk on foot up the long hills, and when I get there they think I am no longer coming. I arrived only last night at Vanden. Today I walk over to see my old friend at Slumberley." Dare leaned forward, laying the tips of his fingers lightly against his breast. "You seem to have had a good deal of walking," said Mr. Elwin, rather taken aback, but anxious to be cordial. "But at any rate you will not walk back. You must stay the night, now you're here, mustn't you, Fanny?" Dare was delighted, beaming. Then his face became overcast, his eyebrows went up. He shook his head. Mr. and Mrs. Elwin were most kind, but he became more and more dejected. "A bag, a simple valise." It could be sent for. Ah, Mr. Elwin was too good. He revived again. He showed his even white teeth. He was about to resume his tea, when suddenly a tall white figure came lightly in through the open French windows, and a clear voice began, "Oh, Uncle John, there is such a heathen of a black poodle making excavations in the flower beds. Do—" Ruth stopped suddenly as her eyes fell upon the stranger. Dare rose instinctively. "This is Mr. Dare, Ruth," said Mr. Elwin. "He has just arrived at Vanden." Ruth bowed. Dare surpassed himself and was silent. All his smiles and flow of small talk had suddenly deserted him. He began patting his dog, which had followed Ruth indoors, and a moment of constraint fell upon the little party. "She is shy," said Dare to himself. "She is adorably shy." Ruth's quiet, self-possessed voice dispelled that pleasing illusion. "I've had a very exhausting afternoon with Mrs. Eccles, Aunt Fanny, and I've come to you for a cup of tea before I go back to Atherston." "Why did you walk so far this hot afternoon, my dear? And how are Mrs. Danvers and Lady Mary? And is anyone else staying there? And, my dear, are the dolls finished?" "They are," said Ruth. "They are all outrageously fashionable. Even Molly is satisfied. There is to be a school feast here tomorrow," she added, turning to Dare, who appeared bewildered at the turn the conversation was taking. "All our energies for the last fortnight have been brought to bear on dolls. We've been dressing dolls morning, noon, and night."
"When is it to be, this school feast?" said Dare eagerly.
"I will buy one, three dolls."
After a lengthy explanation from Mrs. Elwin as to the nature of a school feast as distinct from a bazaar, Ruth rose to go, and Mr. Elwin offered to accompany her part of the way.
"And so that is the new Mr. Dare, about whom we have all been speculating," she said, as they strolled across the fields together. "He's not like his half-brother."
"No, he seems to be entirely a Frenchman.
You see, he was educated abroad, and that makes a great difference. He was a very nice little boy 20 years ago. I hope he will turn out well and do his duty by the place."
The neighbouring property of Vanden, with its tumble-down cottages, its neglected people, and hard agent, were often in Mr. Elwin's thoughts.
"Oh, Uncle John, he will, he must. You must help him and advise," said Ruth eagerly. "He ought to stay and live on the place and look into things for himself."
"I am afraid he will be poor," said Mr. Elwin meditatively.
"Anyhow, he will be richer than he was before," urged Ruth, "and it is his duty to do something for his own people."
When Ruth had said it was a duty, she imagined, like many another young soul before her, that nothing remained to be said, having yet to learn how much beside often remained to be done.
"We shall see," said Mr. Elwin, who had seen something of his fellow creatures, and they walked on together in silence.
The person whose duty Ruth had been discussing so freely looked after the two retreating figures till they disappeared, and then turned to Mrs. Elwin.
"You and Mr. Elwin always go to the school feast tomorrow?"
Mrs. Elwin, a little nettled,
explained that of course she went, that it was her own school feast, that Mrs. Thursby at the Hall had nothing to do with it. Dare did not know who Mrs. Thursby was, but listened with great attention. She, Mrs. Arwin, gave it herself. Her own cook had been with her 5 years, made the cakes, and her own donkey cart conveyed the same to the field where the repast was held. "Miss Daincourt, will she be there?" asked Dare. Mrs. Arwin explained that all the neighbourhood, including the Thursbys, would be there, that she made a point of asking the Thursbys. "I also will come," said Dare, gravely. End of chapter 2.
Chapter 3 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Trumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 3. Atherston was a rambling, old-fashioned black-and-white house, half covered with ivy, standing in a rambling, old-fashioned garden. A charming garden, with clipped yews and grass paths and straggling flowers and herbs growing up in unexpected places. In front of the house, facing the drawing-room windows, was a bowling green, across which, at this time of afternoon, the house had laid a cool green shadow. Two ladies were sitting under its shelter, each with her work. It was hot still, but the shadows were deepening and lengthening. Away in the sun, hay was being made and carried, with cracking of whips and distant voices. Beyond the hayfield lay the silver band of the river, and beyond again the spire of Slumberly Church, and a glimpse among the trees of Slumberly Hall. "Ralph has started in the dog-cart to meet Charles. They ought to be here in half an hour, if the train is punctual," said Mrs. Ralph. She was a graceful woman, with a placid, gentle face. She might be 30, but she looked younger. With her pleasant home and her pleasant husband, and her child to be mildly anxious about, she might well look young. She looked particularly so now as she sat in her fresh cotton draperies, winding wool with cool, white hands. The handwork of some women has a hard, masculine look. If they sew, it is with thick cotton in some coarse material. If they knit, it is with cricket balls of wool, which they manipulate with into wiry stockings and comforters. Evelyn's wools, on the contrary, were always soft, fleecy, liable to weak-minded tangles, and so turning, after long periods of time, into little feminine futilities, for which it was difficult to divine any possible use. Lady Mary Cunningham, her husband's aunt, made no immediate reply to her small remark. Evelyn Danvers was not a little afraid of that lady, and in truth Lady Mary, with her thin face and commanding manner, was a very imposing person. Though past 70, she sat erect in her chair, her stick by her side, some elaborate embroidery in her delicate old ringed hands. Her pale, colourless eyes were as keen as ever. Her white hair was covered by a wonderful lace cap, which no one had ever succeeded in imitating, and fell in soft lappets and graceful folds round the severe, dignified face. Molly, Evelyn's little daughter, stood in great awe of Lady Mary, who had such a splendid stick with a silver crook of her very own, and who made remarks in French in Molly's presence, which that young lady could not understand, and felt that it was not intended she should. She even regarded with a certain veneration the cap itself, which she once met in equivocal circumstances, journeying with a plait of white hair towards Lady Mary's rooms. It was the first time since their marriage, of which she had not approved, that Lady Mary had paid a visit to Ralph and Evelyn at Atherston. Lady Mary had tried to marry Ralph, in days gone by, to a woman who—but it was an old story, and better forgotten. Ralph had married his first cousin when he married Evelyn, and Lady Mary had strenuously objected to the match, and had even gone so far as to threaten to alter certain clauses in her will, which she had made in favour of Ralph, her younger nephew, at a time when she was at daggers drawn with her eldest nephew, Charles, now Sir Charles Danvers. But that was an old story too, and better forgotten. When Charles succeeded his father some 3 years ago, and when, after 8 years, Molly had still remained an only child, and one of the wrong kind, of no intrinsic value to the family, Lady Mary decided that bygones should be bygones, and became formally reconciled to Charles, with whom she had already found it exceedingly inconvenient, and consequently unchristian, not to be on speaking terms. As long as he was the scapegoat son of Sir George Danvers, her Christian principles remained in abeyance. When he suddenly succeeded to the baronetcy at Stoke Moreton, the air of which suited her so well,
and moreover to that convenient pied-à-terre, the house in Belgrave Square, she allowed feelings which she said she had hitherto repressed with difficulty their full scope, expressed a Christian hope that now that he had come to this estate, Charles would put away bohemian things and instantly set to work to find a suitable wife for him. At first, Lady Mary felt that the task which she had imposed upon herself would, D.V., be light indeed. Charles received her overtures with the same courteous demeanour which had been the chief sting of their former welfare. He paid his creditors, no one knew how, for his father had left nothing to him unentailed, and once out of money difficulties, he seemed in no hurry to plunge into them again. If he had not as yet thoroughly taken up the life of an English country gentleman, for want of that necessary adjunct which Lady Mary was so anxious to supply, at least he lived in England and in good society. In short, Lady Mary was fond of telling her friends Charles had entirely reformed, hinting, at the same time, that she had been the humble instrument, in the hands of an all-wise providence, which had turned him back into the way in which the English aristocracy should walk, and from which he had deviated so long. But one thing remained, to marry him. Everyone said Charles must marry. Lady Mary did not say it, but with her whole soul she meant it. What she intended to do, she, as a rule, performed, occasionally at the expense of those who were little able to afford it, but still the thing was, always of course by the cooperation of Providence, done. Ralph certainly had proved an exception to the rule. He had married Evelyn against Lady Mary's will, and consequently without the blessing of Providence. After that, of course, she had never expected there would be a son, and with each year her anxiety to see Charles safely married had increased. He seemed so amenable that at first she could hardly believe that the steed which she had led to waters of such divers merit would refuse to drink from any of them. If rank had no charm for him, which apparently it had not, she would try beauty. When beauty failed, even beauty with money in its hand, Lady Mary hesitated, and then fell back on goodness. But either the goodness was not good enough, or, as Lady Mary feared, it was not sufficiently high church to be really genuine, even goodness failed. For 3 years she had strained every nerve, and at the end of them she was no nearer the object in view than when she had begun. An inconvenient death of a sister, with whom she had long since quarrelled about church matters, and who had now gone where her folly in differing from Lady Mary would be fully, if painfully, brought home to her, had prevented Lady Mary continuing her designs this year in London. But if thwarted in one direction, she knew how to throw her energies into another. The first words she uttered indicated what that direction was. Evelyn's little remark about the dog-cart, which had gone to meet Charles, had so long remained without any response that she was about to coin another of the same stamp, when Lady Mary suddenly said, with a decision that was intended to carry conviction to the heart of her companion, "It is an exceedingly suitable thing." Evelyn evidently understood what it was that was so suitable, but she made no reply. "A few years ago," continued Lady Mary, "I should have looked higher. I should have thought Charles might have done better, but he never could do better than—" said Evelyn with a little mild flatter. "There is no one in the world more—" "Yes, yes, my dear, of course we all know that," returned the elder lady. "She is much too good for him, and all the rest of it. A few years ago I was saying I might not have regarded it quite in the light I do now. Charles, with his distinguished appearance and his position, might have married anybody. But time passes, and I am becoming seriously anxious about him. I am indeed. He is 38. In 2 years he will be 40, and at 40 you never know what a man may not do. It is a critical age, even when they are married. Until he is 40, a man may be led under Providence into forming a connection with a woman of suitable age and family. After that age, he will never look at any girl out of her teens, and either perpetrates a folly or does not marry at all. If the Danvers family is not to become extinct or to be dragged down by a mésalliance, measures must be taken at once." Evelyn winced at the allusion to the extinction of the Danvers family, of which Charles and Ralph were the only representatives. She felt keenly, having failed to give Ralph a son, and the sudden smart of the old hurt added a touch of sharpness to her usually gentle voice, as she said, "I cannot see what has been left undone." "No, my dear," said Lady Mary, more suavely, "you have fallen in with my views most sensibly. I only hope Ralph—Ralph knows nothing about it.
"Quite right. It is very much better he should not. Men never can be made to look at things in their proper light. They have no power of seeing an inch in front of them. Even Charles, who is less dense than most men, has never been allowed to form an idea of the plans which from time to time I have made for him. Nothing sets a man more against marriage than the idea that it has been put in his way. They like to think it is all their own doing, and that the whole universe will be taken by surprise when the engagement is given out. Charles is no exception to the rule. Our duty is to provide a wife for him, and then allow him to think his own extraordinary cleverness found her for himself. How old is this cousin of yours, Miss Dancourt?"
"About 23.
"Exceedingly suitable. Young, and yet not too young. She is not beautiful, but she is decidedly handsome, and very high-bred-looking, which is better than beauty. I know all about her family. Good blood on both sides, no worsted thread. I forget if there is any money." This was a pious fraud on Lady Mary's part, and she was, of course, aware of the exact sum.
"Lady Dancourt left her £30,000, said Evelyn, unwillingly.
She hated herself for the part she was taking in her aunt's plans, although she had been so unable to support her feeble opposition by any show of reason that it had long since melted away before the consuming fire of Lady Mary's determined authority.
£1,200 a year, said that lady. I fear Lady Dancourt was far, very far from the truth, but she seems to have made an equitable will. I'm glad Miss Dancourt is not entirely without means, and she has probably something of her own as well. The more I see of that girl, the more convinced I am that she is the very wife for Charles. There's no objection to the match in any way, unless it lies in that disreputable brother, who seems to have entirely disappeared. Now, Evelyn, mark my words. You invited her here at my wish, after I saw her with that dreadful Albin woman at the flower show. You will never regret it. I am 75 years of age, and I've seen something of men and women. Those two will suit.
Here comes the dog-cart, said Evelyn, with evident relief.
Where is Miss Dancourt?
She went off to Slumberley some time ago. She said she was going to the rectory, I believe.
It is just as well. Ah, here is Charles. A tall, distinguished-looking man in a light overcoat came slowly round the corner of the house as she spoke, and joined them on the lawn. Evelyn went to meet him with evident affection, which met with as evident a return, and he then exchanged a more formal greeting with his aunt.
"Come and sit down here," said Evelyn, pulling forward a garden chair. "How hot and tired you look."
"I'm tired to death, Evelyn. I went to London in May, a comparatively young man. Aunt Mary said I ought to go, and so, of course, I went. I've come back not only sadder and wiser, that I would try to bear, but visibly aged."
He took off his hat as he spoke, and wearily pushed back the hair from his forehead. Lady Mary looked at him over her spectacles with grave scrutiny. She had not seen her nephew for many months, and she was not pleased with what she saw. His face looked thin and worn, and she even feared she could detect a grey hair or two in the light hair and moustache. His tired, sarcastic eyes met hers.
"I was afraid you would think I had gone off," he said, half shutting his eyes in the manner habitual to him. "I fear I took your exhortations too much to heart, and overworked myself in the good cause."
"The season is always an exhausting thing," said Lady Mary, "and I dare say London is very hot now."
"Hot? It's more than hot. It's a solemn warning to evil-doers, a foretaste of a future state."
"I suppose everybody has left town by this time," continued Lady Mary, who often found it necessary even now to ignore parts of her nephew's conversation.
"By everybody, I know you mean one family." "Yes, they are gone. Left London today. Consequently, I also conveyed my remains out of town, feeling that I had done my duty."
"Where is Ralph?" asked Evelyn,
rising, dimly conscious that Charles and his aunt were conversing in an unknown tongue, and feeling herself de trop.
"I left him in the shrubbery. A stoat crossed the road before the horse's nose as we drove up, and Ralph, who seemed to have been specially invented by Providence for the destruction of small vermin, was in attendance on it in a moment. I've seen something of the kind before, so I came on."
Evelyn laid down her work, and went across the lawn, and round the corner of the house in the direction of the shrubbery, from which the voice of her lord and master rose in snatches, as he plunged in and out among the laurels.
"And how is Lord Hope Acton?"
continued Lady Mary, with an air of elaborate unconcern.
I used to know him in old days as one of the best waltzers in London. I remember him very slim and elegant-looking, but I suppose he's quite elderly now and has lost his figure, or so someone was saying.
Not lost, but gone before, I should say, to judge by appearance, said Charles, meditatively, gazing up into the blue of the summer sky.
The mixed impiety and indelicacy of her nephew's remark caused a sudden twitch to the high church embroidery in Lady Mary's hand, but she went on a moment later in her usual tone.
And Lady Hope Acton, is she in stronger health?
I believe she was fairly well. Not robust, you know, but like other fond mothers with daughters out, faint yet pursuing.
Lady Mary bit her lip, but long experience had taught her that it was wiser to refrain from reproof, even when it was so urgently needed.
And their daughter, Lady Grace? How beautiful she is! Was she looking as lovely as usual?
More so, replied Charles with conviction. Her nose is even straighter, her eyelashes even longer than they were last summer. I do not hesitate to say that her complexion is all that her fancy paints it.
You are so fond of joking, Charles, that I don't know when you are serious. And you saw a good deal of her?
Of course I did. I leaned on the railings in the row and watched her riding with Lord Hope Acton, whose personal appearance you feel such an interest in. At the meeting of the Four in Hands, was not she on the box seat beside me? At Henley, were we not in the same boat? At Hurlingham, did we not watch polo together and together drink our tea? At Lord's, did I not tear her new muslin garment in helping her up one of those poultry ladders on the Torrington's drag? Have I not taken her in to dinner five several times? Have I not danced with her at balls innumerable? Have I not, in fact, seen as much of her as of several others?
Oh, Charles, said Lady Mary, I wish you would talk seriously for one moment, and not in that light way. Have you spoken?
In a light way, I should say I have spoken a good deal. But seriously, no. I have never ventured to be serious.
But you will be. After all this, you will ask her?
Aunt Mary, replied Charles with gentle reproach, a certain delicacy should be observed in probing the exact state of a man's young affections. At 35, I know I am 35 because you've told people so for the last 3 years, there exists a certain reticence in the youthful heart which declines to lay bare its inmost feelings, even for an aunt to, we won't say peck at, but speculate upon. I've told you all I know. I've done what I was bidden to do, up to a certain point. I'm now here to recruit and restore my wasted energies, and possibly to heal, observe, I say possibly, my wounded affections in the intimacy of my family circle. That reminds me that that little ungrateful imp Molly has not yet made the slightest demonstration of joy at my arrival. Where is she? Without waiting for an answer, which he was well aware would not be forthcoming, Charles rose and strolled towards the house with his hands behind his back. Molly, he called. Molly! Standing bareheaded in the sunshine under a certain latticed window, the iron bars of which suggested a nursery within. There was a sudden answering cackle of delight, and a little brown head was thrust out amid the ivy.
"Come down this very moment, you little hard-hearted person, and embrace your old uncle."
"I'm coming, Uncle Charles, I'm coming."
And the brown head disappeared, and a few seconds later a white frock and two slim black legs rushed round the corner, and Molly precipitated herself against the waistcoat of Uncle Charles.
"What do you mean by not coming down and paying your respects sooner?" he said, when the first enthusiasm of his reception was over, looking down at Molly with a great kindness in the keen light eyes which had looked so apathetic and sarcastic a moment before.
As he spoke, Ralph Danvers, a square, ruddy man in grey knickerbockers, came triumphantly round from the shrubbery, holding by its tail a minute corpse with outstretched arms and legs.
"Got him!" he said, smiling, wiping his brow with honest pride. "See, Charles? See, Molly? Got him!"
"Don't bring it here, Ralph, please. We're going to have tea,"
came Evelyn's gentle voice from the lawn, and Ralph and the terrier Vic retired to hang the body of the slain upon a fir tree on the back premises, the recognised long home of stoats and weasels at Atherston. Molly, in the presence of Lady Mary and the stick with the silver crook, was always more or less depressed and shy. She felt the pale, cold eye of that lady was upon her, as indeed it generally was, if she moved or spoke. She did not therefore join in the conversation as freely as was her wont in the family circle, but sat on the grass by her uncle
watching him with adoring eyes, trying to work the signet ring off his big little finger, which in the memory of man, of Molly, I mean, had never been known to work off, while he gave him the benefit of small pieces of local and personal news in a half-whisper from time to time as they occurred to her.
"Cousin Ruth is staying here, Uncle Charles."
"Indeed," said Charles absently. His eyes had wandered to Evelyn taking Ralph his cup of tea and giving him a look with it, which he returned, the quiet, grave look of mutual confidence which sometimes passes between married people, and which for the moment makes the single state seem very single indeed. Molly saw that he had not heard, and that she must try some more exciting topic in order to rivet his attention.
"There was a mass of prayers yesterday, Uncle Charles."
"There wasn't."
Uncle Charles was attending again now. Molly gave an exact account of the great event, and of how Nanny had gathered her skirts round her, and how James had laughed, only Father did not see him, and how there was a great deal more, and the story ended tragically for the mouse, whose foul demise under a shovel, when prayers were over, Molly described in graphic detail. "And how are the guinea pigs?" asked Charles, putting down his cup.
"Come and see them,"
whispered Molly, insinuating her small hand delightedly into his big one, and they went off together, each happy in the society of the other. Charles was introduced to the guinea pigs, which multiplied exceedingly since he had presented them, the one named after him being even then engaged in rearing a large family. Then, after Molly had copiously watered her garden, and Charles's unsuspecting boots at the same time, objects of interest still remained to be seen and admired, confidences had to be exchanged, inner pockets in Charles's waistcoat to be explored, and it was not till the dressing bell and the shrill voice of Nanny from an upper window recalled them that the friends returned towards the house. As they turned to go indoors, Charles saw a tall white figure skimming across the stretches of low sunshine and long shadow in the field beyond the garden, and making swiftly for the garden gate.
"Oh, Molly, Molly!"
he said in a tone of sudden consternation, squeezing the little brown hand in his.
"Who is that?"
Molly looked at him astonished. A moment ago, Uncle Charles had been talking merrily, and now he looked quite sad.
"It's only Ruth," she said reassuringly.
"Who is Ruth?"
"Cousin Ruth," replied Molly. "I told you she was here."
"She's not staying here."
"Yes, she is. She's rather nice, and she says the guinea pigs smell nasty, which isn't true.
She will be late," with evident concern, "if she's going to be laced up, and I know she is, because I saw it on her bed. She doesn't see us yet. Let us go meet her." "Run along, then," said Charles, in a tone of deep dejection, loosing Molly's hand. "I think I'll go indoors." End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 4.
"I've done Uncle Charles a buttonhole and put it in his water bottle," said Molly in an important affair whisper
as she came into Ruth's room a few minutes before dinner, where Ruth and her maid were struggling with a black lace dress.
"Mrs. Jones, you must be very quick. Why do you have pins in your mouth, Mrs. Jones? James has got his coat on, and he's going to ring the bell in 1 minute. I told him you had only just got your hair done, but he said he could not help that. Uncle Charles," peeping through the door, "is going down now, and he's got on a beautiful white waistcoat. He's brought that nice Mr. Brown with him that unpacks his things and plays on the concertina. Ah, there's the bell."
And Molly hurried down to give a description of the exact stage at which Ruth's toilet had arrived, with Ruth cut short by appearing hard upon her heels. "It's a shame to come indoors now, isn't it?" said Charles, as he was introduced and took her in to dinner in the wake of Lady Mary and Ralph. "Just the first cool time of the day."
"Is it?"
said Ruth, still rather pink with her late exertions. "When I heard the dressing-bell ring across the fields, and the last gate would not open, and I found the railings through which I precipitated myself had been newly painted, I own I thought it had never been so hot all day." "How trying it is to be forgotten," said Charles, after a pause. "We've met before, Miss Daincourt, but I see you don't remember me. I gave you time to recollect me by throwing out that little remark about the weather, but it was no good." Ruth glanced at him and looked puzzled.
"I'm afraid I don't," she said at last. "I've seen you playing polo once or twice and driving your four in hand, but I thought I only knew you by sight. When did we meet before?"
"'You have no recollection of a certain ball after some theatricals at Stoke Moreton, which you and your sister came to as little girls in pigtails?'
"'Of course I remember that. And were you there?'
"'Was I there? Oh, the ingratitude of woman! Did not I dance 3 times with each of you, and suggest chicken at supper instead of lobster salad? Does not the lobster salad awaken memories? Surely you have not forgotten that!'
Ruth began to smile. "'I remember now. So you were the kind man, name unknown, who took such care of Anna and me. How good-natured you were!'
"'Thanks. You evidently do remember now, if you say that. I recognised you at once, when I saw you again, by your likeness to your brother Raymond. You were very like him then, but much more so now. How is he?'
Ruth's dark grey eyes shot a sudden surprised glance at him. People had seldom of late inquired after Raymond.
"'I believe he's quite well,' she replied in a constrained tone. "'I've not heard from him for some time.'
"'It's some years since I met him,' said Charles, noting but ignoring her change of tone. "'I used to see a good deal of him before he went to—was it America? I heard from him about 3 years ago. He was prospecting, I think, at that time.'
Ruth remembered that Charles had succeeded his father about 3 years ago. She remembered also Raymond's capacities for borrowing. A sudden instinct told her what the drift of that letter had been. The blood rushed into her face.
"'Oh, he didn't, did he?'
The other 3 people were talking together. Lady Mary, opposite, was joining with a bland smile of inward satisfaction in the discussion between Ralph and Evelyn as to the rival merits of Cochin Chinas and Plymouth Rocks.
"'If he did,' said Charles quietly, "'it was only what we had often done for each other before.
There was a time, Miss Dancourt, when your brother and I both rowed in the same boat. Both, I fancy, split on the same rock. It was not so long since—' There was a sudden silence. The chicken question was exhausted. It dropped dead. Charles left his sentence unfinished, and, turning to his brother, the conversation became general. In the evening, when the others had said good night, Charles and Ralph went out into the cool half-darkness to smoke, and paced up and down on the lawn in the soft summer night. The 2 brothers had not met for some time, and in an undemonstrative way they had a genuine affection for each other, which showed itself on this occasion in walking about together without exchanging a word. At last Charles broke the silence. "'I thought when I settled to come down here you said you would be alone.' There was a shade of annoyance in his tone. "'Well, now, that is just what I said at the time,' said Ralph sleepily, with a yawn that would have accompanied a Jonah. "'Only I was told I did not understand.' They always say I don't understand if they're set on anything. I thought you wanted a little peace and quietness. I said so, but Aunt Mary settled we must have someone. I say, Charles, with a chuckle of deep masculine cunning, you just look out. There's some mystery up about Ruth. I believe Aunt Mary got Evelyn to ask her here with an eye to business.
I would not do Aunt Mary the injustice to doubt that for a moment, replied Charles, rather bitterly, and they relapsed into silence and smoke.
Presently Ralph, who had been out all day, yawned himself into the house, and left Charles to pace up and down by himself. If Lady Mary, who was at that moment composing herself to slumber in the best spare bedroom, had heard the gist of Ralph's remarks to his brother, I think she would have risen up and confronted him then and there on the stairs. As it was, she meditated on her couch with much satisfaction, until the sleep of the just came upon her, little recking that the clumsy hand of brutal man had even then torn the veil from her carefully concealed and deeply laid feminine plans. Charles, meanwhile, remained on the lawn till late into the night. After 2 months of London smuts and London smoke and London nights, the calm, scented darkness had a peculiar charm for him. The few lights in the windows were going out one by one, and thousands were coming out in the quiet sky. Through the still air came the sound of a corncrake perpetually winding up its watch at regular intervals in a field hard by. A little desultory breeze hovered near, and just roused the sleepy trees to whisper a good night. And Charles paced and paced, and thought of many things. Only last night. His mind went back to the picture gallery where he and Lady Grace had sat amid a grove of palms and flowers. Through the open archway at a little distance came a flood of light and a surging echo of plaintive, appealing music. It was late, or rather early,
for morning was looking in with cold, dispassionate eyes through the long windows. The gallery was comparatively empty for a London gathering, for the balconies and hall were crowded, and the rooms were thinning. To all intents and purposes, they were alone. How nearly he had asked for what he knew would not have been refused. How nearly he had decided to do at once what might still be put off till tomorrow. And he must marry. He often told himself so. She was there beside him on the yellow brocade ottoman. She was much too good for him, but she liked him. Should he do it now? He asked himself, as he watched the slender gloved hand swaying the feather fan with monotonous languor. But when he took her back to the ballroom, back to an expectant, tired mother, he had not done it. He should be at their house in Scotland later. He thought he would wait till then. He breathed a long sigh of relief in the quiet darkness now at the thought that he had not done it. He had a haunting presentiment that neither in the purple heather, any more than in a London ballroom, would he be able to pass beyond that certain point to which, in divers companionship, with or without assistance, he had so often attained. For Charles was genuinely anxious to marry. He regarded with the greatest interest every eligible and ineligible young woman whom he came across. If Lady Mary had been aware of the very serious light in which he considered Miss Louisa Smith, youngest daughter of a certain curate Smith, who in his youth had been originally extracted from a refreshment room at Liverpool to become an ornament of the church, that lady would have swooned with horror. But neither Miss Louisa Smith, with her bun and sandwich ancestry, nor the 8th Lord Breakwater's young and lovely sister, though both willing to undertake the situation, were either of them finally offered it. Charles remained free as air, and a dreadful stigma gradually attached to him as a heartless flirt and a perverter of young girls' minds from men of more solid worth. A man who pleases easily and is hard to please soon gets a bad name among mothers. I don't think Lady Hope Acton would have thought very kindly of him had she sped up to Scotland in the night mail. Perhaps he was not so much to blame as she thought. Long ago, 10 long years ago, in the reckless days of which Lady Mary had then made so much, and now made so little, poor Charles had been deeply in love with a good woman, a gentle, quiet girl, who after a time had married his brother Ralph. No one had suspected his attachment, Ralph and Evelyn least of all, but several years elapsed before he found time to visit them at Atherston, and I think his fondness for Molly had its origin in his feeling for her mother. Even now it sometimes gave him a momentary pang to meet the adoration in Molly's eyes, which, with her dark lashes, she had copied so exactly from Evelyn's. And now that he could come with ease on what had been forbidden ground, he had seen of late clearly, with the insight that comes of dispassionate consideration, that Evelyn, the only woman whom he had ever earnestly loved, whom he would have turned heaven and earth to have been able to marry, had not been in the least suited to him, and that to have married her would have entailed a far more bitter disappointment than the loss of her had been. Evelyn made Ralph an admirable wife. She was so placid, so gentle, and, with the exception of muddy boots in the drawing-room, so unexacting. It was sweet to see her read to Molly, but did she never take up a book or a paper? What she said was always gracefully put forth, but, oh, in old days, used she in that same gentle voice to utter such platitudes, such little stereotyped remarks? Used she, in the palmy days that were no more, when she was not Ralph's wife, so mildly but so firmly to adhere to a preconceived opinion? Had she formerly such fixed opinions on every subject in general, and on new-laid eggs and the propriety of chicken hutches on the lawn in particular? Disillusion may be for our good, like other disagreeable things, but it is seldom pleasant at the time, and is apt to leave in all except the most conceited natures, whose lifelong mistakes are committed for our learning, a strange, self-distrustful caution behind, which is mortally afraid of making a second mistake of the same kind. Charles suddenly checked his pacing. And yet, surely, surely, he said to himself, there were in the world somewhere good women of another stamp who might be found for diligent seeking. He turned impatiently to go indoors. Oh, Molly, Molly, he said half aloud, gazing at the darkened windows behind which the body of Molly was sleeping, while her little soul was frisking away in fairyland, with which reflection he brought his meditations to a close for the night. End of chapter 4. Chapter 5 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 5. Molly awoke early on the following morning, and early informed the rest of the household that the weather was satisfactory. She flew into Ruth's room with the hot water to wake her and set her mind at rest on a subject of such engrossing interest. She imparted it repeatedly to Charles through his keyhole, until a low, incoherent muttering convinced her that he also was rejoicing in the good news. She took all the dolls out of the baskets in which Ruth's careful hands packed them the evening before, in the recognised manner in which dolls travel without detriment to their toilets, namely, head downward with their orange-top boots turned upwards to the sky. In short, Molly busied herself in the usual ways in which an only child finds employment. It really was a glorious day. Except in Molly's eyes, it was almost too good a day for a school feast. Too good a day, Ruth thought, as she looked out, to be spent entirely in playing at endless games of Sally Water and Oranges and Lemons, and in pouring out sweet tea in a tent. She remembered a certain sketch at Arley, an old deserted house in the neighbourhood, which she had long wished to make. What a day for a sketch! But she shut her eyes to the temptation of the evil one, and went out into the garden, where Molly's little brown hands were devastating the beds for the approaching festival, and Molly's shrill voice was piping through the fresh morning air. There had been rain in the night, and today the earth had all her diamonds on, just sent down, reset from heaven. The trees came out resplendent, unable to keep their leaves still for very vanity, and dropping gems out of their settings at every rustle. No one had been forgotten. Every tiniest shrub and plant had its little tiara to show. Rare jewels cut by a master hand, which, at man's rude touch, or for that matter, Molly's either, slid away to tears. "You don't mean to say, Molly," said Charles, later in the day, when all the dolls had been passed in review before him, and he criticised each, "that you're going to leave me all day by myself? What shall I do between luncheon and tea-time, when I have fed the guinea pigs and watered the bluebellia, as you call it? Where has that imp disappeared to now? I think," with a glance at Ruth, who was replacing the cotton wool on the dolls' faces, "I really think, though I own I fancied I had a previous engagement, that I shall be obliged to come to the school feast, too." "Don't," said Ruth, looking up suddenly from her work with grey, serious eyes. "Be advised, no man who respects himself makes himself common by attending village school feasts and attempting to pour out tea, which he is never allowed to do in private life." "My good hand buns," suggested Charles. "You take a gloomy view of your fellow-creatures, Miss Dancourt. I see you underrate my powers with plates of buns." "Far from it. I only wished to keep you from quitting your proper sphere." "What, may I ask, is my proper sphere?" "Not to come to school feasts at all, or if you feel that is beyond you, only to arrive when you are too late to be of any use, to stand about with a hunting-crop in your hand, for of course you will come on horseback. And then, after refreshing all of us workers by a few well-chosen remarks, to go away again at an easy canter." "I think I could do that, if it would give you pleasure, and I am most grateful to you for pointing out my proper course to me. I have observed it is the prerogative of woman in general not only to be absolutely convinced as to her own line of action, but also to be able to point out that of man to his obtuser perceptions." "I believe you are perfectly right," said Ruth, becoming serious. "If men, especially prime ministers, were to apply to almost any woman I know, except of course myself, for advice as to the administration of the realm or their own family affairs, I have not the slightest doubt that not one of them would be sent empty away, but would be furnished instantly with a complete guide-book as to his future movements on this side of the grave." "Oh, some people don't stop there," said Charles. "Aunt Mary, in my young days, used to think nothing of the grave if I had displeased her. She still revels in a future course of justice, and an eternal cat-o'-nine-tails beyond the tomb." "Well, Molly, so here you are back again. What's the last news?" The news was the extraordinary arrival of 5 new kittens, which, according to Molly, the old stable cat had just discovered in a loft, and took the keenest personal interest in. Charles was dragged away, only half acquiescent, to help in a decision that must instantly come to, as to which of the two spotted or the three plain ones should be kept. It was a day of delight to Molly. She had the responsibility and honour of driving Ruth and the dolls in her own donkey cart to the scene of action, where the schoolchildren, some of the idlest or most good-natured of Mrs. Alwyn's friends, were even then assembling, and where Mrs. Alwyn herself was already dashing from point to point, buzzing like a large bumblebee. As the donkey cart crawled up, a grey figure darted out of the tent and flew to meet them from afar. Dare, who had been on the lookout for them for some time, offered to lift out Molly, helped out Ruth, held the basket, wished to unharness the donkey, let the wheel go over his patent leather shoe, and in short made himself excessively agreeable, if not in Ruth's, at least in Molly's eyes, who straightway entered into conversation with him, and invited him to call upon herself and the guinea pigs at Atherston at an early date. Then ensued the usual scene of festivities of this description. Tea was poured out like water, very like warm water. Buns, cakes, and bread and butter were eaten, were crumbled, were put in pockets, were stamped underfoot. Large open tarts, covered with thin sticks of pastry, called by the boys the tarts with the grubs on them, disappeared apace, being constantly replaced by others made in the same image, from which the protecting but adhesive newspaper had to be judiciously peeled. When the last limit of the last child had been reached, the real work of the day began, the games. Under a blazing sun, for the space of 2 hours, Sally Water, or Nuts in May, must be played, with an occasional change to Oranges and Lemons. Ruth, who had before been staying with the Alwyns at the time of their school feast, hardened her heart, and began that immoral but popular game of Sally Water. Sally, Sally Water, come sprinkle your pan, rise up a husband, a handsome young man. Rise, Sally, rise, and don't look sad, you shall have a husband, good or bad. The last line, showing how closely the state of feeling of village society, as regards the wedded state, resembles the view taken of it in the highest circles. Other games were already in full swing. Mrs. Alwyn, flushed and shrill, was organising an infant troop. A good-natured curate was laying up for himself treasure elsewhere by a present expenditure of halfpence secreted in a tub of bran. Dare, not to be behindhand, took to swinging little girls with desperate and heated good nature. His bright smile and genial brown face soon gained the confidence of the children, and then he swung them as they had never been swung before. It was positively the first time that some of the girls had ever seen their heels above their heads. And his powers of endurance were so great. First his coat and then his waistcoat were cast aside as he warmed to his work, until at last he dragged the sleeves of his shirt out of the socket and had to retire into private life behind a tree, in company with Mrs. Eccles and a needle and thread. But he reappeared again, and was soon swept into a game of cricket that was being got up among the elder boys. Bowled the schoolmaster, batted brilliantly and with considerable flourish for a few moments, only to knock his own wickets down with what seemed singular want of care, and then fielded with cat-like activity and an entire oblivion of the game, receiving of a swift ball on his own person, only to choke, call himself up, and recover his equanimity and the ball in a moment. All things come to an end, and at last the slumbery church clock struck 4, and Ruth could sink giddily onto a bench and push back the few remaining hairpins that were left to her, and feebly endeavour, with a pin eagerly extracted by Dane from the back of his neck, to join the gaping ruin of torn gathers in her dress, so daintily fresh 2 hours ago, so dilapidated now. "There they come," said Mrs. Alwyn, indignantly, who was fanning herself with her pocket-handkerchief, which stout women ought to be forbidden by law to do. "There are Mrs. Thursby and Mabel, just like them arriving when the games are all over. A dear me, who is that with them? Why, it is Sir Charles Danvers. I had no idea he was staying with them. Brown particularly told me they had not brought back any friend with them yesterday. Dear me, how odd. And Brown, Sir Charles Danvers is staying at Atherston," said Ruth. "At Atherstone, is he? Well, my dear, this is the first I've heard of it, if he is. I don't see what there is to be any secret of in that. Most naturally he should be staying there, I should have thought. And if that's one of Mabel's new gowns, all I can say is that yours is quite as nice, Ruth, though I know it is from last year, and those full fronts are as fashionable as ever." As Mr. and Mrs. Alwyn went forward to meet the Thursbys, Charles strolled up to Ruth and planted himself deliberately in front of her. "You observe that I am here," he said.
"I do."
"At the proper time?"
"At the proper time."
"And in my sphere?" "I've tampered with no buns, you will remark, and teapots have been far from me."
"I am exceedingly rejoiced my little word in season has been of such use.
The remark you made this morning I considered honest, though poor, and I laid it to heart accordingly. But," with a change of tone, "you look tired to death. You've been out in the sun too long. I am going off now. I only came because I met the Thursbys, and they dragged me here. Come home with me through the woods. You have no idea how agreeable I am in the open air. It would be shady all the way, and not half so fatiguing as being shaken in Molly's donkey cart."
"In the donkey cart I must return, however, if I die on the way," said Ruth with a tired smile. "I can't leave Molly. Besides, all is not over yet. The races and prizes take time. When at last they are dismissed, a slice of—"
"No, Miss Dacre, no, not more food."
"A slice of cake will be applied externally to each of the children, which right brings the festivities to a close. There, I see the dolls are being carried out. I must go."
And a moment later, Ruth and Molly and Dare, who had been hovering near, were busily unpacking and shaking out the dolls, and Charles, after a little desultory conversation with Mabel Thursby, strolled away with his hands behind his back and his nose in the air in the manner habitual to him. And so the day wore itself out at last, and after a hymn had been shrieked, the children were dismissed, and Ruth and Molly at length drove away.
"Has it been delicious?" said Molly, "and my doll was chosen first. Lucy Big, with the rash on her face, got it. I wish little Sarah had had it. I do love Sarah so very much, but Sarah had yours, Ruth, with the real pocket and the handkerchief in it. That would be a surprise to her when she gets home. And that new gentleman was so kind about the teapots, wasn't he? He always filled mine first. He's coming to see me very soon, and to bring a curious black dog that he has of his very own called—"
"Stop, Molly," said Ruth, as the donkey's head was being sawed round towards the blazing high road.
"Let us go home through the woods. I know it is longer, but I can't stand any more sun and dust today." "You do look tired," said Molly, "and your lips are quite white. My lips turned white once before I had the measles, and I felt very curious inside, and then spots came all over. You don't feel like spots, do you, Cousin Ruth? We'll go back by the woods, and I'll open the gates, and you shall hold the reins. I dare say Barnum will like it better."
Molly had called her donkey Barnum, partly owing to a misapprehension of scripture narrative, and partly owing to the assurance of Charles, when in sudden misgiving she had consulted him on the point, that Barnum had been an ass. Barnum's reluctant underjaw was accordingly turned in the direction of the woods, and little thinking the drive might prove an eventful one, Ruth and Molly set off at that easy amble which a well-fed, pampered donkey would occasionally indulge in. End of chapter 5.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.